Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Long and Winding Royal Road. Our look back at the classic 1990s era of All Japan Pro Wrestling. And today we have a historic match that in many ways, like many people would argue, is the kickoff point of the start of what we call the Four Pillars era of All Japan Pro Wrestling. And it's Mitsuhara Misawa, the ace, the soon-to-be ace of All Japan Pro Wrestling, versus the current ace at this time, Jumbo Tsuruta. This comes from June 8th, 1990, from the All Japan Pro Wrestling Superpower Series 1990 Tour, Day 19 at Budokan Hall. And joining me today, a very good friend of mine over in the United Kingdom, it's JP Houlihan from the Grapple Spotlight and the Grapple Roundtable. JP, how are you today?
Very well, sir. Absolutely delighted to be on. How is it? At least you're not in Sumo Hall during the summer in Japan and you're coping with this horrific heat that we're recording through at the minute.
Well, I mean, we're recording this during, you know, global pandemic and that includes, like, you know, pretty high numbers, relatively speaking, in Tokyo. So the chances of me going to anywhere for watching a wrestling show, let alone in Tokyo, are pretty slim. Yeah. I don't know what they're going to do for the G1 this coming fall. I'm not going. So
I remember a comment you made, which was no vaccine, no WH.
Exactly.
And I think that's possibly the soundest policy when it comes to going wrestling at the moment. And yeah, over here in the UK, we don't really have much of a wrestling scene at the moment. So it's been great having us on to be able to kind of dive back into a bit of All Japan history. And absolute pleasure to be on with you again.
Well, I mean, you've been on previous shows with me before, mm-hmm. and we talked about primarily New Japan Pro Wrestling, and we talked about kind of like how you got into that. But let's talk about All Japan. And I know for a fact that you are a big fan of All Japan Pro Wrestling of this era. And I want to kind of find out for myself and let the listeners know, like, JP, how did you get into, like, the 1990s All Japan?
I was thinking about this, and the first kind of exposure I would have had in a very kind of rudimentary way in terms of being familiar with names would have been through some of the APTA mags. And at the very back, that you remember, they'd have the top 10 listings. And I think they had one, just for Japan, didn't they? Mm-hmm. And at that point, I was aware of, like, All Japan and New Japan. And New Japan awareness kind of came primarily through WCW and the kind of talent relationship there. Whereas All Japan was through these magazines and then very much kind of into the Power Slam era, Superstars of Wrestling Power Slam era. And at that point, it was getting into tape trading. And it's such a stereotype, but the first set of tapes that I ended up getting involved sort of King of the Death matches, the bit of New Japan from the mid-90s. I think it was like Hashimoto, the Three Musketeers. And then at that point, it was like a mixtape of All Japan. And at that stage, it was like, oh, wow, this is amazing. But I never understood the sort of nuances. It was watching great wrestling, but I wasn't aware of these kind of characters as much. But yeah, that was my first exposure really to All Japan.
And who would you say, like, of, you know, the wrestlers who are like the main event stars at that time in the company, which particular wrestler, like, really stood out for you?
It's funny, because I wouldn't say necessarily he was like a proper main eventer until sort of the latter part of the decade. But for me, it was always the Kobashi story. And it was the kind of inherent sympathy that he drew. And I don't know, it's sometimes I think it's just the sort of expression that he has as much as anything else. So Kobashi was always the one that I liked. But then also later on, there was, you know, he'd had the match with Joe and things with that as well. So, and I was watching Noah in that early part. So I always think that Kobashi is one that I've kind of felt more, and because he'd always take the fall and he's so good at selling, he was always the one I was most drawn to.
Yeah. For me, it was always, Kawada. Like, I don't know why. Like, I just saw this guy with, you know, like black tights and yellow kick pads and just beating the shit out of people with like these massive kicks to their face. I was like, this guy's totally for me. I love this guy. But I also love Kobashi a lot. And I think for me, it was like the pecking order from like who I enjoyed watching the most was like Kawada, Kobashi, Misawa, and then Tawa. And then mixed in there was like Jun Akiyama and of course Stan Hansen and Terry Gordy and Steve Williams in there as well. But yeah, so then later actually, because like I didn't get into this until like the late 90s, so like I'm not super aware of Jumbo Tsuruta, who we're going to talk about today. But you know, going back to watch Jumbo in the early 90s and even earlier in his career, like you know when he's like wrestling for the AWA, he wins the AWA World Title from Bockwinkel, and then he loses it to Rick Martel, and then Stan Hansen wins it from Rick Martel, which is kind of interesting, I think. But watching him back then and then seeing his progression, it's really interesting, and we'll talk about this during the review of this match, is how he's like this bridge from the 80s into the 90s and how he really fits both those styles.
Oh, yeah. He really does. I mean, in some ways, he's like the I was thinking about this. It's like he's very much two steps from Ricky Dozan, isn't he? So he's got obviously the bridge to Baba and taking that on from that kind of late 70s throughout the 80s as well. But you'd think of him as he's part of the base for what the four pillars built upon. Without him and without this match, do we get the Misawa that we ultimately get and the kind of, you know, the hot streak that they had throughout the 90s. He is very much that kind of bridge. And he's a fascinating worker because of the amount of sort of American influence on him, I think, as well. And it's these stuffs, and I always think during this lockdown period, I found myself going back and watching quite a bit of 90s All Japan. And there's so many great guides and various other things that when you start to see the kind of like the kind of emotional story and journey that they're going on, I think there's something about Jumbo, and because of his early death, that's really tragic about him. And I think that's one of the things that has really like I'm kind of really fascinated by Jumbo Tsuruta at this point.
Yeah, I've really kind of done a recent deep dive into Jumbo in the last several months leading up to the first episode, that was episode zero of this series, looking at the formation of the Triple Crown. But just watching a ton of Jumbo in the late 80s is just amazing to watch because he's wrestling mainly with people of his peers like Tenryu and Hansen and Brody and Riki Choshu and people like that. And then like how he kind of pivots towards like working with this new generation of guys like the, you know, Misawa, Kawada, Kobashi, Tawa, and how they're bringing a more, you know, more dangerous style and a more hard-hitting style into the promotion that, you know, they see the groundwork led by Tenryu and Jumbo, and then they take it to another level. But then Jumbo is right there with them during that period where they're developing. And also, it's also worthy to note that, you know, Stan Hansen, another guy who started in the 70s, worked throughout the 80s, is also keeping pace with them. And these guys are now in their 40s, like, or hitting 40. And it's amazing to see, like, you know, the wear and tear, like, on their bodies from the 80s is like, not really stopping them from working this new 90s style that's just, like, taking over all of Japan, not just, you know, not just in all Japan, but in New Japan and various other promotions as well.
Oh, yeah. It's amazing how much he kind of keeps up at points. And I think also it plays really well into the kind of narratives around Jumbo as the kind of the guy who's on the downturn, and there's so much of him proving that he can still keep up. And he's having to work this very dynamic style. I mean, especially in this match, because Misawa as a wrestler is still sort of between the Misawa that we know and Tiger Mask 2 in terms of his style. That's, you know, and that feels very deliberate, and it's a natural kind of evolution of where he progresses from. But it's a hell of a job that they're managing to keep up, and for the duration of these matches as well. I mean, between this and the rematch, they're both about 20. I mean, this one's what, 23 minutes. I think that the rematch is sort of closer to about sort of 27. So he's, and you know, you've noticed with a lot of these matches is as much as they're working kind of rest holds, they're not really downtime. And he's keeping pace with them throughout all of this, which for a big guy like Jumbo is a hell of an achievement.
Yeah, definitely. And he's like, you know, he's about to hit 40. You know, he's, I think he's still 49 at the time of this match, but he's either 40, he's just going to hit 40, and, you know, he's put his body through a lot of wear and tear. But let's talk about this match. It's from June 8th, 1990, and I'm going to give a bit of a background before we get into it here, JP. So it's important to note that, like, just before, you know, this match in earlier in the year, Jinichiro Tenryu, who was going to be, like, kind of the new ace of the company, you know, like, he was, even though he's kind of a peer of Jumbo, he's not, he's kind of in that 1B position. That he just, like, won the Triple Crown. And the thing with him was that he had left All Japan. He resigned from the company. He went to form a company called Super World Sports. And this left, you know, All Japan promoter Giant Baba with a bit of a quandary, as, you know, Jumbo is about to hit his 40s and had spent the last decade, you know, basically destroying his body in wars, not only with Tenryu, but with Stan Hansen, with Bruiser Brody, Riki Choshu, among a ton of other wrestlers. And, you know, Baba, you know, saw this, like, vacuum being created in his company, and he desperately needed to elevate his younger talent. And he decided the person to spearhead that particular movement was Mitsuhara Misawa. And now, talking about Misawa here, at this time, Misawa was still wrestling as Tiger Mask 2, a gimmick that All Japan had kind of licensed away from New Japan Pro Wrestling. And he, you know, like, as Tiger Mask 2, it was very unremarkable. JP, I don't know, have you seen the Tiger Mask 2 Bret Hart match?
No, I haven't.
You don't have to bother. It's kind of shit, actually. It's surprisingly not good, because, like, here are two of the best workers in the history of wrestling, and they don't have a good match. I think part of politics was probably a big factor in that. And you know, like, I maybe, you know, Misawa and Bret just weren't clicking, like, and probably would never have clicked, because, like, I think Bret wouldn't have really liked the All Japan style of, like, hitting really hard.
Yeah, I was going to say, in terms of stylistically, and sometimes you like to think, okay, sort of opposite styles make matches. That's not a style if one person is working really stiff and the other one doesn't like to work it that way and prides themselves on not sort of taking injuries and not causing any injuries as well. I could kind of see how that could happen. I'm intrigued now you mention it. But also, I always think of the stuff that I have seen of the Tiger Mask 2 run. It's not a very spectacular run. It's not that he's obviously not a bad wrestler or anything like that, but it doesn't seem... It's almost like the moment that he takes off the mask is the real significance of Tiger Mask 2 itself.
Yeah, so there's a tag match that he has with Toshiaki Kawada as his partner. And they're fighting, who are they fighting? Samson Fuyuki and Yoshiaki Yatsu. And just, you know, a random tag match, you know. And then at some point, you know, Misawa tells Kawada, hey, take this mask off of me. And then Kawada's like, okay, and he takes it off. Takes off that mask and he throws it into the ground. Like, he, like, it's just like this albatross that was around his neck and he just got rid of it. And the fans go nuts. Like, they're chanting his name. They know who he is. They know that that's Misawa under that mask. And obviously, you know, it's very clear that the fans were clamoring to see Mitsuhara Misawa. They didn't want to see him as Tiger Mask 2. They wanted to see the real person, the rookie that they probably were following before his excursion to Mexico and before he came back as Tiger Mask 2. And so it's just amazing. And you can see why, like, you know, Baba, you know, went with him because of, like, this charisma, this connection he had already had with the fans, even though he was wrestling under a mask for maybe a year or two before this.
Oh, yeah. It's and he looks so young as well, doesn't he? And even in the rematch, which is only a couple of months later, he looks a lot more grizzled, I think, after this match as well. But it is that kind of crowd charisma. And you see the way that they pop when Kawada takes off the mask and then he throws it off into the crowd. Like, they completely lose it. It's obviously playing into the thing that, you know, this atmosphere you hear from this match. I mean, it's kind of intangible. And it's not like, you know, it's not like the man was... It's a kind of unusual charisma, isn't it? It's not like it's kind of great, kind of what we would think these days, or could he cut a promo? Because even after this match, it seems like it's a very... He's somewhat quite shy and subdued still. He isn't someone who's like a big talker. But his charisma is just that kind of sheer stoicism. And also, you know, I know you're going to mention it as well, but it's that elbow, and it's that elbow to Jumbo that I think... in many ways changes the perception of what maybe a lot of the All Japan audience saw him at that time.
definitely. So from here, Misawa, you know, like, so he's going to spearhead this younger generation. So he had formed this group called the Super Generation Army with Kawada, with Kendo Kobashi, Akira Taue, and Tsuyoshi Kikuchi. And these are all the younger members of the roster who are kind of like picked to be, okay, you guys are going to go into the main events or be in the semi-main events. And so like that's, and you're going to be led by Misawa. And in return, Jumbo formed Tsurutagun, which basically means Tsuruta Army, for those of you who don't speak Japanese. And this is a faction of people from his generation and older wrestlers like Yoshiaki Yatsu. And this is before Yatsu jumps to Super World Sports with Tenryu later on. Masanobu Fuchi, the Great Kabuki, and Mighty Inoue, who doesn't, and the last two, Kabuki and Inoue, don't really factor into the more significant parts of the Jumbo versus, you know, Super Generation feud that happens over the next like 2 or 3 years. Tsurutagun would later get bolstered when, you know, they get their own younger talents to jump ship over to their side with the acquisition of Akira Taue. And also, and later on, we would see the inclusion of a young junior heavyweight by the name of Yoshinari Egawa, who is still wrestling to this day in Pro Wrestling Noah, JP.
Isn't he a champion there as well?
I think he's one half of the tag champions at this.
He is one half. Which, I from having seen the sort of latest Noah show, it was something I saw when he popped up, and I was like, oh my God, like 2020, here we are. But yeah, it was. I loved the idea of the Taue move, just because it obviously kind of sets him apart, and he wasn't as sort of naturally charismatic as the other. But it's also very. It makes a lot of sense. If you want to be the ace, why wouldn't you want to learn from the ace as well, rather than being kind of against them? So is it really as close to a kind of angle per se as sort of All Japan do around this time?
Yeah, I mean, they have angles, like, you know, throughout their history. But this is kind of like, I would say, you know, like the encompassing program in the company, you know, that everything kind of takes a back seat to. Like, I mean, here's the thing, like the match we're going to talk about, this headlined this Budokan show, not the Triple Crown title match between, I think it was Stan Hansen and Terry Gordy. You know, that's how much Baba thought of this program between Jumbo and Misawa, that he made it the main event, not the title match for the top belt in his company, which, you know, it's just telling, right? But also, like, I think that's, if you headline that, if you don't headline with that, I think the Triple Crown match is probably really going to be disappointing for people.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, I mean, we get to the kind of essence of the feud, isn't it? And it's one of the kind of great stories of, you've got the battle for the ace of the promotion, and you've got the ace who's been on top pretty much as like the, you know, the kind of big native star, and he's on the downturn with the guy who's clearly on the rise as well. And it's that kind of foreboding feeling that kind of creates, and the kind of emotions that happen around it. But, and I mean, with the benefit of hindsight, I mean, there are so many sort of, I heard stories that he went to Jumbo about the idea for the four pillars, and it was something that Jumbo went, yeah, this is what we could do. But yeah, it's a phenomenal feud. And like you say, how could you have any other match like following this? You'd have to headline with it. And also it would have been the ultimate test of, it would have been the confirmation of him that Misawa is the guy to go with. And he is a draw if he's able to get this kind of reaction in a sold out Budokan.
Yeah, so, and before we get to the match itself, so we got to talk about a key match in the Super Generation Army versus Tsurutagun feud. And this happens on May 26th, 1990 at Korakuen Hall, where the team of Misawa, Kendo Kobashi, and Akira Taue take on Jumbo Tsuruta, Masafuchi, and the Great Kabuki. And JP, it's during this match, Jumbo basically bullies and beats up all three Super Generation Army members. But at one point, you know, Misawa has had enough of this shit and just levels Jumbo off of the apron with his elbow strike to Jumbo's face. And it has to be said that the Jumbo selling of this elbow was tremendous. I mean, he looked like he was knocked out cold by it, to the point where no one was paying attention to what was going on in the ring while Jumbo was lying on the floor. Like, everyone was like, is he okay? Oh my God, did Misawa really, you know, like, you know, knock him out or something like that? And this elbow, this lone elbow strike has two effects, you know, that resonate, you know, into the future. One, it sparks the hatred of Jumbo for Misawa that leads to the match we're going to talk about today. And number two, it starts the establishment of this elbow as one of the, you know, the Misawa's most dangerous weapons and one of the most deadliest, you know, strikes in all of, you know, All Japan Pro Wrestling, which is, you know, considering, like, we're talking about Kawada's kicks, we're talking about Kobashi and Stan Hansen's lariats, we're talking about, the Johnny Ace's Ace Crusher. Well, we're not talking about Johnny Ace's Ace Crusher, but, yeah. you know what I mean? But, you know, like, this is a legendary move to the point where, like, someone like, you know, Chris Hero basically adopts it and it's his finisher and it's directly lifted from Mitsuhara Misawa.
Mm. It is, isn't it? And it is the thing it's this elbow that becomes the thing that kind of makes him, it sounds really silly to say this, just like a strike of an elbow, but it kind of makes him it's almost like the separation away from the moveset he would have had with Tiger Mask 2 as well. It's the kind of harder, it adds like the harder edge to Misawa for it. And like you say, the selling of it when I've seen that is just absolutely tremendous on Jumbo's part. And it just, like you say, in that, it's funny to say that in this day and age when we think of how convoluted booking can get, and you see such a simple thing as an elbow strike leading to someone going down, and that is part of your build and the kind of, obviously, the kind of pull apart that happens as a result of that, the way that it kind of explodes really into this.
Oh, yeah, I mean, like, as you're saying, like, you know, as soon as Jumbo recovers, he immediately just goes after Misawa. Like, he mounts him, he's trying to beat the shit out of him, and they'd have to do a pull apart. It's generating all this tremendous heat. So, like, you can imagine everyone in Corken Hall at that show is like, oh my God, I have to see these two fight in a singles match. And so that brings us to, you know, June 8th at the Budokan Hall. And there's a very famous apocryphal story. I don't know how true this is. But it basically details, like, Giant Baba's booking decision. So it's said that, you know, Baba up to this day was deciding who's going to go over. Jumbo, Misawa. But at the Budokan, like the day of the show, he decides that Misawa was going to go over because he was amazed at the chance of Misawa before the show. He was amazed at, like, the response Misawa was getting during the tour leading up to the show. And, like, in between, apparently during lulls between each match on the show, JP, like, people were buzzing about him or chanting his name. And, like, apparently his merchandise was selling incredibly well. Like, Baba went out to the merchandise table to see how well, you know, people's merchandise was selling. He's like, oh, all Misawa's shit is gone. Oh, my God. Like, okay. So from there, you know, he sends a messenger to Jumbo's locker room saying Misawa's going over, and then Jumbo sends the messenger back asking double count out DQ, what's the finish? And then Baba says, no, clean finish, you're putting him over. And that's the great thing about Giant Baba, and I think one of the keys to the success of All Japan was that Baba's word was final. No one fucked with Giant Baba. Like most of the people that worked for him respected him, but also they understood that his word is final. Like, if you don't like his booking decision, you can not come back to work for him.
Yeah, exactly. And you need that, don't you? You need that kind of, almost in a sense, that person who is not afraid enough to kind of say that. And it's funny. You think of a lot of wrestlers who would have really lost the plot a bit about being asked to do that kind of on the fly. And I can imagine he would have been possibly a bit pissed off behind the scenes, but I also like to think he's smart enough to realize where this is going, and that in the wake of Tenryu leading, that it's like, okay, this is like quite a shift from what we would normally do, but maybe that's the thing that kind of jolts things up. And so, and you know, between that and the rematch as well, like, you know, Jumbo's almost, you know, he's telling that story, because to be honest, how many people would have expected Misawa to win that night?
Oh, probably no one. I mean, I think there's genuine shock. We'll get to it when we get to, you know, the end of the match. But I do think there's, like, genuine shock and surprise that he wins the match. Mm. But yeah, we'll get to that. But, you know, let's start the video. We're gonna hit the play button, and already, you know, before anything happens, JP, the Misawa chants have already started.
Mm.
Misawa, yeah. Misawa, Misawa. And then we start soon after we hear the strains of Spartan X, Misawa's theme, and the chants are now in unison with this legendary theme song. He's accompanied to the ring by Toshiaki Kawada and Kenta Kobashi. Basically, they're his security because they have to keep these rabid fans from attacking Mitsuharu Misawa as he's making his way from the dressing room to the ring.
Oh, absolutely. They're tearing into it, and bless him, he completely no-sells all of the fans, doesn't he, when he's going through.
Have you ever seen some of these, like, you know, especially in All Japan, have you seen, like, where people are being accompanied to the ring and all the seconds, all the young boys, like, have to, like, stop the fans from touching the wrestlers? Like, you know, like, I've seen, like, people like Marufuji in his younger days just push people back. Like, they don't give a fuck. They just, get the fuck away from our guy. Get away, get away. Like, and I've seen, like, I don't know, like, probably Akiyama's done it too, I'm sure, you know, like, yeah. Kenta's just push fans back. Like, they don't care. Like, you're not messing with our guy on his way to the entrance. You're not stopping him. We got to get this match started. But, you know, out next is Jumbo Tsuruta out to his theme song, J, simply titled J. And, you know, in Jumbo's corner, we see his top lieutenant, the great Masafuchi. And the referee for this match is the legendary and incredible Kyoei Wada, my favorite ref of all time, even though he's kind of like lost the plot a little in the last 2 years in his old age. But he's just my favorite ref of all time because he's so fucking amazing. And you can see why in this match, JP.
Oh, you can. It made me think of at times. In some ways, I know you're not a big football fan necessarily, but in football, it's always kind of thought if you don't really notice the referee, then they're doing an excellent job. And I think with this, that everything kind of works so smooth. So even though he's kind of taking parts, particularly at points when Jumbo's getting annoyed and he'll shout at the referee. I think there's a point when Misawa slaps him and he sort of looks at the referee horrified. And then there's points where he gets involved, but in some ways, he's just like a part of the story, isn't he? And he plays his role so well, but he doesn't take anything away from the wrestlers. You know, he's like that perfect referee who does the thing of enforcing the rules, but also doesn't distract your attention.
Well, he's like the anti-Red Shoes Uno.
Yeah. Yeah, which even in and of itself, because of the red shoes, he's noticeable. But then obviously you get all the kind of, you know, when he's play acting at ringside, whereas here it's, you know, everything is deadly, deadly serious.
Yes. So I have to ask you, JP, your opinions on Spartan X and J as theme songs.
I've heard a good bit of J over the last, when I've done the research for this match, because I watched the match against Hansen, the two matches against Tenru, the rematch. I like it, but Spartan X just sticks in your head once you've heard it for long enough as well. A couple of absolute great themes, like proper, in some way, like you hear them and you become very nostalgic and it reminds you of a sort of particular place from when you first kind of hear these themes that, you know, felt so different from other stuff that I was watching at the time.
Could you see yourself dancing to this during your rave days in your baggy jeans and glow sticks, necklaces and stuff?
You'd need some chemical assistance, I suppose, to probably get into it. I'd give it a go. Like, if they played this in a nightclub, I'd be like, yeah, all right, I'll start dancing to it. I might be the only one, but I'd be doing that, and I'd have to somehow try and fit in a couple of elbow smashes against, I don't know, a table or something like that in the meantime.
Maybe you have to go to, like, the Hacienda in Manchester and maybe make a jungle version of this song.
Well, that was open in 1990 at the Hacienda. So in some ways, they could have done that. He was quite experimental, wasn't he, Tony Wilson? So he would have I could see him doing some sort of remix, getting you order to sample Spartan X in a song. I think I could have seen him doing that.
Wasn't Peter Hook a DJ at the Hacienda?
Yeah, he was.
He could remix that. Put a bit more bass on that thing.
Yeah, exactly. Him and Bernard Sumner, they can crack on with that, can't they?
Well, not anymore because they hate each other. But anyways,
always the way.
Back to the match. So at the beginning, Jumbo offers a handshake to Misawa, but Misawa casually blows him off, which plays into the larger story of their overall feud. So I thought that was a really nice detail that they had here. Jumbo dominates the opening minutes of this match with his power, using a shoulder tackle and body slam to send Misawa into the mat. Misawa avoids Jumbo's jumping knee and hits Jumbo with a dropkick, but Jumbo immediately just comes back with a boot straight to Misawa's chin, and right off the bat, they're just laying the groundwork, really establishing that this is going to be a very high-impact match, and like just kind of like the animosity between these two right away.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like you said, it's when Misawa sort of blows off the handshake, and you realize, and also as well, you can tell that Jumbo's come into this match cocky, which might well belie what he was really feeling, but he plays it as like, I'm cocky, I've got this kind of big strength advantage. I like the dropkick big boot sequence as well. He does a great big boot, and I did wonder whether Kevin Nash took some ideas for how to deliver a big boot from how Jumbo does here. But like you say, really good open start, and it sets up the idea of the, you know, the youth and speeds versus the kind of experience and size.
JP, I know you're a big Kevin Nash man, but let's be honest here. If Kevin Nash tried to hit the height of his leg that Jumbo did, he would tear his quad in like seven different places again.
Oh, absolutely, he would do. But it'd be one great big boot. You'd be left with this like brilliant big boot he does, and then he's just not able to wrestle again afterwards.
No. Jumbo continues the assault on Misawa with a vicious clothesline and an uppercut reminiscent of his trainer, Dory Funk Jr. I'm watching these Jumbo matches, and I look at the influence that you see from Dory Funk Jr., but also Terry Funk, in the way, like, some of his punches, like Jumbo's punches to someone's face, when he just doesn't give a fuck and he just, like, wants to punch somebody, they're very much like a Terry Funk punch. Have you noticed that?
I have. It was one of the things I was thinking about. I was like, he's a great NWA worker, isn't he? And he did obviously spend a lot of time with the Funks in Amarillo, and he's really learned from it. And in some ways, it's kind of the great thing about Jumbo, isn't it? He's had so much kind of good brawling experience with some great brawlers from, you know, the 70s and 80s. And he's able to sort of still tie that in with his Olympian style as well. And these are things that kind of get lost, because he's not out of place with Misawa's offense, and he wouldn't be out of place with, you know, the offense of a Terry Funk if they were going to have just like a wild brawl as well.
Well, if you think about, like, you know, when he's starting out, like he's trained by the Funks in Texas, and then he works in the United States for a while, particularly in the Amarillo, like the territory for the Funks, and then he comes back to Japan, and then he's working with the Funks, with them and against them. He's working Stan Hansen, he's working Bruiser Brody, he's working Abdul the Butcher. So, like, obviously, these are all things that, you know, like, he's absorbing through working with these legendary figures, especially, like, a lot of these guys are really great brawlers, and he doesn't necessarily become a brawler himself. I would never say he's a brawler-type wrestler. I think, like, Minoru Suzuki, oddly enough, is a more of a brawler-style wrestler than Jumbo Tsuruta, even though he doesn't have that kind of background with the kind of people that Jumbo has. But Jumbo knows his strength is that he's an awesome wrestler, and so, like, he mixes the brawling with the wrestling in a perfect blend, in my opinion.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And because of that, when you have the transitional sequences and you've got the ebb and flow, and it's Misawa on top and then you've got Kobashi on top as well, he's able to vary up what that is. So there'll be a strike exchange, and then there'll be the battle for a suplex. And then he will do things as well. We'll talk about it when he sort of throws a drop kick into the mix. And he has got this kind of varied offense as well. And he looks like, especially as it goes kind of later on through the match, I like the ragged nature of his offense as well, that kind of wildness. And, you know, talk about he's working with the great brawlers of the time. I think that's one of the things he managed to kind of, he picked up in that. And he just subtly brings it in, rather than bringing in, it's being too overt with it. Because he's still sort of staying true to himself as a former Olympian, that he should be utilizing wrestling first and foremost.
From here, Misawa avoids Jumbo's deadly backdrop suplex and uses the momentum to get a pin attempt on him. And this is a recurring strategy throughout this match from both, you know, Misawa and Jumbo, but more so Misawa. Like, he's trying to use the momentum of, you know, Jumbo's moves, of like Jumbo's inertia in some of the bigger moves he does, like the backdrop suplex, clotheslines, things like that, German suplexes against, you know, against him. And this is kind of where like his junior heavyweight style kind of comes into play.
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And it's, I think the idea as well is that like Jumbo's comfortable being able to do these moves and be dominant, but he's up against someone who has such a sort of defined advantage with him over him in terms of, you know, him being a junior wrestler not that long ago and still having that kind of flashy move set that he's able to kind of reverse. And like you say, it's the constant theme, isn't it? It's about how the kind of experience of knowing when to use the momentum of your opponent against them.
Yeah, from here, Misawa sends Jumbo to the outside with a sliding dropkick and follows up with his signature flip over the top rope onto the apron. And from here, he just floors Jumbo with a dropkick that sends, you know, Jumbo crashing over the into the guardrails. And then Misawa follows him out onto the floor, and he hits him with that vicious elbow smash. And this sends Jumbo over the guardrails right in front of the commentator's table where Giant Baba is sitting. And I got to imagine Giant Baba is just like being like completely amused by all of this.
Oh, I'm like, he must have just been grinning like a Cheshire cat inside, really, about this particularly. And it's a great, like I say, it's a great sequence. We're sort of so familiar with him doing the flip over, but it's the other thing about when Misawa does dynamic offense, how dynamic it is, because and how good a job Jumbo does selling it, going right into the guardrail. And then when he hits in the elbow and he sort of flies over as well, again, you know, proving how dangerous the elbow is. And I can imagine he was sat there just thinking, Christ, we're going to pull this off, lads. And he, you know, he must have been resisting every urge. And yeah, it's always it's a highlight of me is kind of hearing Baba on commentary every once in a while, because the tone of his voice is so different from anyone else, because he sounds like he should be a wizard in Lord of the Rings.
Which one? Is he Gandalf?
I was trying to think, yeah, like the proper "you shall not part." Like, he's very much kind of doing that. And like you said earlier on, like I can remember like hearing it and then you're hearing him say "Tiger Mask" and then kind of moving on very quickly. Yeah, Baba on commentary, it's nice. It's not like he's an overbearing commentator, is it? He's not okay. Vince McMahon.
Everyone, you've heard it here first. Giant Baba is the Ian McKellen of wrestling commentators.
Yep. Hey, that's high praise. High praise.
It is. I'm a big Ian McKellen fan. I think he has a great voice as well as an actor. From here, Jumbo tries to get back into the ring, but Misawa continues with the elbow shots, knocking Jumbo off the apron again. And then he follows up with the plancha over the top rope. Again, you know, just another example of Misawa incorporating this high flying style that he used as Tiger Mask 2 and that he would use like throughout the, you know, even the later stages of his career into like the late 90s. Less so, I think, like at this point, I think he becomes more of a like an impact wrestler, like just big bombs and big strikes. But he never gets rid of like all of his, you know, flying moves. He keeps quite a few of them still in his later years.
Which is good, isn't it? Because in some ways, that's the story of the character, isn't it? His excursion to Mexico and the things he would have learned and the things he would have learned as part of his role as Tiger Mask 2. And then being able to kind of just pull off those high impact moves when they matter the most, while still being able to kind of, and then kind of incorporating the very much the famous striking style that we think of him today.
Jumbo finally gets back in and is now really weary of Misawa and spends a couple of minutes just keeping his distance while getting his bearings back, just the sign of a great veteran. Misawa goes back to his elbow shots, and there's this great moment, JP, where you see Masafuchi on the floor just admonishing Kyo Iwata about the possible illegality of these elbows, which I just thought was a great moment. It's a great moment because if you don't notice it, it doesn't detract from the match, but if you see it, I just think it just kind of enhances it in just that little bit, you know?
Oh, yeah, I think it really does. And it's the kind of thing you notice on those kind of second, third viewings. And I don't know, you know, I remember seeing that on the second viewing of that. And it's great. But it's also, there's the points when you can hear a Kawada or a Kobashi, like, you know, when he's in the Boston Crab, and you can just hear them yell Misawa in order to kind of wake him up to do that. And the role of the seconds being there as well, which, you know, it's great. And again, it adds to the drama.
Yeah, from here, they actually, you know, they slow the pace down at this point. They're trading holds back and forth, and including a sequence of reversals of, like, I don't know what this move is called, where they, you know, they hold each other's arms behind their opponent's back.
I was trying to think for that. It's like a reverse test of strength, where one of the people stood with their hands behind their back, if that makes sense. But you're still able to turn it round, though.
Yeah, just like it's I don't know exactly what this move is called. It's hard to describe. It's so simple, but it's hard to describe. But anyways, that's what they do for a good portion of this part of the match. Finally, Misawa gets the better of that particular sequence, doing a backwards dropkick to Jumbo. Misawa gets a control segment with a standing hammerlock on Jumbo Tsuruta. There's a collar and elbow lockup that sees Misawa slap Jumbo in the face instead of giving a clean break. And this is a mistake of sorts on Misawa's part, because this really pisses Jumbo off. If he wasn't pissed off before this point, JP, he is now pissed off at this punk for doing this.
Oh, it's great, isn't it? And it's the lack of, because it fits so well up against the kind of bully character that he has as well, of someone sort of slapping him around the face going, I'm not going to take that. And then how pissed off he gets. But he's quite canny as well, because he also, it's not like he kind of completely loses his shit and just starts kind of laying into him, isn't it? It's the idea about, you know, it's almost like Misawa's trying to destabilize Jumbo. He's trying to wind him up. He's doing these things to kind of get him angry and show that he's not scared of him.
I do think there's a psychological element in Misawa's strategy against Jumbo. Like, you know, this is a guy who's been wrestling for like 30 years and has been the top guy in the company. It's not just going to be like, you know, physically wearing him down. He has to psychologically wear him down to the point where, you know, Jumbo's going to mistake that Misawa's going to capitalize on. I think that's really kind of like what I take away from watching this match like a couple of times.
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And it plays on the arrogance of Jumbo, doesn't it? As the ace, that this is.
Yes, sorry. Go ahead.
No. Carry on.
So from this point, Jumbo regains control with a jumping knee that connects this time on Misawa. And JP, like, who has a better jumping knee than Jumbo Tsuruta? The answer is nobody.
No one.
Fuck nah. Triple H. Fuck Kenny Omega. Jumbo's jumping knee is better than all of theirs.
And it looks so believable as well. It works. Oh, it's lovely the way he does it. It's amazing, isn't it? A jumping knee, which in today's day and age would be something that wouldn't mean too much here. It's just like, it's filled with complete significance.
No knee slapping here, JP. No knee slapping.
Oh,
here.
No. Jumbo doesn't do that shit, does he? He's not slapping that thigh for no one.
Nope, not at all. He's also not like pretending that wrestling is a video game, but that's neither here or there. From here, Jumbo applies the abdominal stretch, which Misawa reverses, and then Jumbo reverses that by hip tossing Misawa over the top rope onto the floor. Misawa comes back into the ring, and Jumbo hits a beautiful double underhook suplex, and again, like showing off, like just what an incredible technical wrestler that he is. He then slaps on a sleeper hold. And this is one of my favorite Kyoi Wada spots. Wada just immediately jumps in there to make sure it's not an illegal chokehold. He's like, check. He's putting his fingers under the Jumbo's arm, making sure it's not under the chin. It's just, you know, like, you don't notice Wada until you have to notice Wada. And this is a point where you have to notice that there's a competent referee making sure that nothing illegal is happening during this part of the match.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And it's, you know, he does. It's you know, it's a spot that it didn't last for a particular long amount of time, but you can just see him going in and working his way around to kind of check the entirety of the hold as well. And it's the kind of thing that keeps up the integrity of the match, if you're going to think of it like that, by making sure that for this to work, all of the components need to be believable. And this is just an idea of this as well. And it's kind of, you're kind of thinking, well, what should a referee be doing in those moments? Well, logically, he'd be checking to make sure that this is a legal move.
He'd be a great MMA referee, wouldn't he?
I was going to say, yeah. It's an MMA mentality, which you wonder at times, is that a good mentality for sort of referees to take on board?
I think so. I think if you want realism in your wrestling product, then, you know, If you're a company like, you know, the WWE, no. If you're a company like most American companies like WWE or AEW, like, you probably don't necessarily want that. I don't think New Japan necessarily wants that in their product, but I think, you know, at this time, you know, it fit perfectly because that's what Jumbo was. That's what Baba was going for. He's going for pivoting away, like, from, you know, like, these really, you know, so he booked a lot of outlandish characters in his company, you know, a lot of gimmicks and stuff like that. And then he pivots towards, like, this kind of more traditional straight wrestling style. He still books a lot of, like, you know, gimmicky foreigners, like the Headhunters from Puerto Rico. He books Giant Kamala too. Not the original one who just passed away, rest in peace, but, and characters like that. Like, he would bring in the Road Warriors, the Great Kabuki, you know, wrestlers like that into the 80s All Japan. But, you know, for the most part, the main event scene is all serious wrestlers. Like a lot of the stuff that are more, that's more gimmicky is, like, in the mid-card or the lower part of the card. And so I think, you know, having Kyo Iwata and other referees just kind of being more, like, treating it as a sport, it just makes the product better.
Yeah. And it's, like you said, it's what Bubba's going for. And it fits the aesthetic. If he was running a kind of an overtly silly promotion, then having that kind of referee probably wouldn't work. But this is what he's going for. It's the way that the entire matches are kind of produced as well. It's, you know, big fight feel. And big fight feel, the idea of it is your big fights have the best referees.
Yeah, so from here, Jumbo sends Misawa into the ropes, and then he lifts him into the air. And then as Misawa's coming down, he just drives him face first into the mat. He tries this again, but, you know, Misawa uses the momentum of the move to hit Jumbo with a dropkick in midair. So keeping with the theme of using Jumbo's momentum against him, Misawa follows up with a top rope dropkick. Again, back to another theme that we talked about. He really loves using his junior heavyweight repertoire during you know, this early part of his unmasked career.
Yeah, it really is, isn't it? It's the, like we were saying earlier on, it's the kind of transitions, but within the narrative, it's the transition of his career, but within the narrative of the match as well, it's the idea that this is the stuff that Jumbo wouldn't normally have to prepare for in a Triple Crown or a big sort of Budokan main event. So the idea of it kind of taking him by surprise, but also showing as well a glimpse of what the future of All Japan will be like, and perhaps what the style of wrestling will be like as well. So there's the kind of the glimpses of that kind of much more, like, some more flashy elements that would go in, that the kind of stuff that Jumbo wouldn't do, but it wouldn't fit Jumbo to ever do that. So, you know, we spoke about it being a bridge, and in many ways it's like a kind of bridge of styles as well.
Well, I mean, Jumbo acts as a great base for Misawa's high flying stuff.
Yeah, you know? and his timing is so good.
I gotta think, like, you know, I'm trying to think who he would have worked that had a high flying style in the 80s. I don't know if, like, the Mil Máscaras or Don Karras were working him that much in the 80s. I have to go back and look at that. But, you know, it's not like Misawa's fucking Rey Mysterio or anything like that.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
still, like, he has to catch this guy jumping off the top rope. I'm pretty sure that Great Kabuki never, or Riki Choshu never jumped off the top rope while Jumbo was on the floor and he had to catch either of those guys. So it's a testament to, like, how he's also willing to kind of adapt to this kind of more high risk, you know, style, where he has to actually, you know, he's running as great a risk as Misawa is jumping off the top rope because he has to catch this guy.
Yeah, he's, I don't know how he kind of feels with it as well, but it again works because he does this, he does a great kind of baffled face, Jumbo, at points where it just appears like, what the hell is going on around me? I'm not normally in this kind of situation. And when there are these types of moves, you see him kind of stumble around like he's proper David and Goliath stuff, except you just sort of blow on Goliath and he's sort of stumbling around, like not knowing where he is.
Yeah, from here, Misawa is firmly in control of the match. He's wearing Jumbo down with strikes and slams and hits his version of the frog splash for a two count. Misawa goes for a cross body press, but, you know, Jumbo, he now uses the strategy of using momentum against his opponent. He catches Misawa and then drops him throat first into the top rope. And I got to think that's kind of deliberate. Like, you know, fuck you. I'm tired of your shit. Here, I'm just going to, you know, kind of like decapitate you with the top rope.
It's fucking horrible. You just think so many things could have gone wrong at that point. Especially when he was involved in a main event with Tenryu where he knocked him out with a power bomb as well. It looks brutal. And as a WCW fan, I was always a fan of Steve Austin's early finishes, the stun gun. And this is just like a horrible version of that where he just sort of catches him, just drops him throat first. But it feels like such a big kind of moment in this match as well, of the kind of ebb and flow of it. So it's horrible. You see it. And then there's a great shot, isn't there, where the camera overhead is looking down on Misawa as he's sort of stunned, feeling up around his neck.
Yeah, I think one thing you gotta admire is, like, there's some really great camera work because it's not overbearing with the amount of cuts or anything. Because it's shot like a sport. That's the other thing. It's not shot like a TV show or entertainment product. It's shot like a sport. And this is something Japan has always been good about, I felt, with the way they shoot wrestling matches is that, you know, because obviously, you know, ProRes is very much, you know, treated like a sport, especially at this time. So, you know, we get great shots like this and the impact of moves and catching moves. And it's not always perfect, mind you, but it's better than a lot of the shit we see these days. From here, Jumbo follows up that throat drop into the top rope with a Terry Funk-like pile driver for a big two. And again, like, you know, who were his trainers, JP? Dory Funk Jr. and Terry Funk. And it's so evident in the way that, you know, he does some of these moves.
Oh, yeah. Going to say here, the pile driver, the spinning toe hold. I think he does a variant on that as well at some point. Well, not like a proper spinning toe hold, but certainly like a toe hold as well. Like you said earlier on, the kind of punches. It's great because it's high impact, but they're not overused as well, which is one of the great things I've found about watching Jumbo back, is the way he spaces those big high impact moves. So they mean more to the crowd. So the crowd will react.
Jumbo then hits his Thez press for a two. And I got to say, you know, I love Jumbo, but sometimes this Thez press that he does is really sloppy. It's not as good as like Steve Austin's.
Oh, no. He's kind of too big for it. Really, in some ways, I get why he's going for it, but also as well, like you say, he's nearly 40. His knees have probably had, you know, not far off their kind of, you know, last legs themselves. So, yeah, him doing it. Although I will say, there's something about that kind of ragged offense in these big matches when people are worn down that I always kind of enjoy. It's like the rough edges on, if I see a match that's too smooth, sometimes I don't like it, feels too much of like a kind of sheen on it, whereas moments like this are where, like, you know, where is that bit more rough around the edges, like say when he drops Misawa on his throat on the rope, like those are the things that I kind of, yeah, I like that about Jumbo.
Jumbo continues dominating Misawa for a good several minutes here and leads him to go to the top rope to do something. Misawa tries to block him and hit a superplex, but, you know, Jumbo knocks him down with a straight punch to the face. I guess that's, you know, the Terry Funk-like thing there. He's able to hit Misawa with an awesome-looking top rope version of his jumping knee for a close two. JP, this fucking move was awesome.
Oh, fucking great. Like you said earlier on, like, those jumping knees he does are great. And the crowd, like, at that point, like, this is the point where the crowd start to get really hyper as well.
Oh, yeah, I made a note. The crowd is really starting to get louder for these two counts now we're seeing. And like, we're getting into pretty much the crescendo part of the match because, like, after this, a power bomb from Jumbo, two count. Misawa reverses a double underhook suplex into a backslide for a two count. Misawa then follows up with an elbow to Jumbo's face, which gives him some much-needed distance and time away from Jumbo. So, like, just, you know, the desperation now is in Misawa. Like, he's has to, like, just not just go for the pin, but like he needs to separate himself away from Jumbo to kind of like heal and rest and get his second wind.
Yeah, it's like you say, in some ways, when you present this like a sport and you produce kind of, it is like an MMA context, isn't it? Where his strength is his kind of his speed and his agility and being able to move around. So you have to kind of create that distance as you would do in a real fight. Whereas Jumbo is the bigger man. He's going to want to keep him in close because what works best for him.
Yeah, from here, Jumbo has slid to the outside to recover. And Misawa is able to hit a basement dropkick on Jumbo while he's on the floor. And then he follows up with a high risk. And I mean high risk. Top rope splash. This is something that you would see, you know, Tanahashi do in like big G1 finals or big IWGP heavyweight title matches. Like this is Misawa doing. Of course, Misawa is like, you know, still young at this point, but still it's like it's not something you would normally see in All Japan at this time. And like the fans are going nuts for this move.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's great though when he does it. And it's like we said earlier on, it's that idea of kind of merging these kind of much more spectacular high spots that they're going to be seeing a lot more of in as the 90s go on.
Back in the ring, and both men are jockeying for position. But again, Misawa uses Jumbo's momentum against him to roll him into the ropes and then to an O'Connor roll for a very close two. And the fans, JP, the fans are going nuts now. They are just like on their feet, like jumping up from their seats, like sitting back down, jumping back in from their seats every time they think a finish is coming. And all of Budokan is so loud. It must be, for me, it was like, wow, this is such a stark contrast to the wrestling we've been seeing in 2020.
Mm. Oh, yeah. It's wonderful to see because it's kind of the way the crowd get in this. It's like it's very raucous because I always think that there is, you know, we have the idea of what we think a Japanese wrestling crowd are like. But here there's a real wildness to that crowd. I mean, they're really losing it and shouting it. And it's not like throughout this, like Jumbo's the obvious heel or anything else. There is a lot of, you can hear those Saruta old chants as well at points. But at the same time, they're so behind Misawa as well. They really want him to win this. And it's great. And it's the thing that adds into the kind of folklore around the match.
Misawa hits a spinning heel kick to Jumbo's face and tries for a frog splash. But Jumbo gets his knees up and immediately covers Misawa for two. I don't know why, but like people getting hit in the face in All Japan just makes me laugh.
Yeah, and there's a lot of it. Christ, when Kawada really starts getting on the scene then at that point. But yeah, I liked how Jumbo plays possum for the second frog splash as well. And then again within that kind of narrative logic of the match, like when he goes for the for that kind of Boston crab as well, the idea that that's the thing that would ground that type of offense from him.
There's a big Misawa chant. Like,
oh yeah,
now just consistently going on amongst the people in Budokan Hall. Misawa, Misawa. You know, the great thing about Misawa's name is that it's so easy to chant.
It's perfect, isn't it? I mean, in some ways, you've got that, though, also with Kawada, and you've got that with Kobashi as well, isn't it? It's they've set themselves up well phonetically for some really high-powered chants.
Oh, yeah, like Hansen's kind of the odd man out. Hansen, because you need three syllables. He's only got two. Like,
exactly.
Like with Jumbo's name. Jumbo, oh, like they add an extra O for the phonetic effect. But Hansen is kind of hard to do. Johnny Ace doesn't really lend itself either to chants. Well, that's okay. He is never a huge star in All Japan Pro Wrestling. Yeah, I'm gonna be eating my words. Though, JP, if someone picks a fucking, you know, global energetic tough tag match with Kobashi and Johnny Ace and the Patriot in it that I have to review and I have to maybe eat my words and say, yeah, you know, Johnny Ace wasn't bad in All Japan. But anyways, we're not here to talk about Johnny Ace. I don't want to get bogged down by Johnny Ace talk. Anyways, where am I here? Vicious body slam into a vicious Boston crab from Jumbo onto Misawa. But Misawa is thankfully too close to the ropes. Jumbo lariat, big two count, and I love, like, we talk about, you know, Stan Hansen's lariat. I fucking love Jumbo Tsuruta's lariat, JP. It's a thing of beauty.
It is. It's great. And it's quite controlled, isn't it? Compared to, like, Hansen, where it's just like, I'm blind and I'm going to take your head off and you just got to hope for the best on these things. But it's such a good impact move from him as well. And it's it's the way he kind of mixes up his offense, doesn't he? And yeah, it's a great lariat in a time of very fine lariats, in the best company in the world for lariats.
Exactly. Jumbo goes for the backdrop suplex. But, you know, Misawa's positioned really close to the corner, so he's able to kick off the top turnbuckle and, again, uses the momentum of this move to escape what would surely be the end of the match for him if Jumbo was able to hit it. There's a German suplex with a bridge from Misawa, but, you know, Jumbo barely kicks out at 2.9. Not 2. 2.9, JP. Like, it's really fucking close.
Oh, it is. And they lose their shit. And it's a lovely German as well, which I don't know if you notice it throughout this match. There's not... One of the things we always think of All Japan is the kind of serious amount of head and neck trauma. But in this match, in some ways, there isn't any of those kind of really horrific kind of on the proper kind of neck drop kind of moments throughout this. And it's such a love, it's a lovely German for it as well. And it's the fact that the angle you see it from the camera, it's like he's facing the camera, Jumbo, when he takes it back. So you can kind of just see his face that he pulls a kind of like, oh shit face as he's going backwards and it's for the 2.9. It's great.
Jumbo reverses a Tiger Driver attempt into a bridge pin for only a 2 count here. Jumbo sends Misawa into the corner where Misawa rebounds into a body press attempt, but Jumbo answers with a Misawa-like elbow of his own to the top of Misawa's head, but JP, he makes a crucial mistake because this elbow strike to Misawa's head hurts his elbow as much as, like, I'm sure the shot to Misawa's head did to Misawa.
Yeah, it's a great moment because it's so good in terms of how he hits him. And it's just the way he crumbles over to the other side of the ring and he just starts shaking his elbow at that point. And it's this idea... that I kind of like throughout this match where Jumbo has, like, obviously each wrestler has their strengths and their weaknesses, but it's very kind of apparent that Misawa's weaknesses he's working on and he's going to get better and he's going to get a lot better over time. Whereas for some of these things, I think for Jumbo, there's a realization that that's a weakness and that he's not going to be able to remedy it because he's heading towards the kind of the end, he's closer to the end of his career than he is to the beginning, and he's kind of turned over from that. So the idea of him holding his elbow because he hasn't got an elbow like Misawa's is a great little moment.
I mean, my theory, you know, JP, is that, you know, Jumbo's elbow is obviously not as calcified or calloused as Misawa's. Obviously, Misawa's been training it Muay Thai style, hitting the punching bag or a stone pillar with his elbow to, like, really get it hard. And so, yeah.
Like a Van Damme routine and say kickboxer.
Exactly. Like, he's elbow boxing, you know?
Yeah.
That's what Misawa's doing, but, like, Jumbo's not doing this. So this hurts him as much as it does Misawa. And Jumbo's selling of just, you know, this part of this match, this elbow, like his elbow hurting, it's incredible. Like, I don't think people give, I don't know, like, how many people talk about Jumbo and, like, how awesome he is at selling. Like, I think he might be one of the, like, the top three sellers in the history of all of professional wrestling.
Well, it's, do you know why? It's because because he doesn't oversell. And he has the great thing of absorbing punishment, but not wanting to show it. Whereas towards the end of this, he's becoming ragged. And so it's hitting him now. It's having that real impact. And he spaces out when he should be feeling like that, when he's kind of on the ropes. Yeah, I'd agree with you on that. In some ways, because we don't have the overkill of him selling. It just gives whatever selling, the real kind of overselling that he does, has so much more significance to it. Like you mentioned earlier on in the six-man tag with the elbow, that's so important. I mean, that the whole start of this, in some ways, is entirely dependent on a sell job from Jumbo Tsuruta. That kind of gives the momentum for this match and then where it goes from there. So, I mean, his selling is absolutely integral to it.
From here, like, he has another chance to sell something because Jumbo tries for a dropkick while Misawa is on the ropes, but Misawa avoids it and Jumbo crotches himself into the ropes. Poor Jumbo. He does a really good sell job here. I don't know if it's actually selling or it's actually, like, this really hurt him.
I think he hurt his knackers. in fairness. But he does it so well. It's like a really fun, because he jumps on and he kind of does a bit of a wild swing and then goes back in. And there's that kind of impact. And it's like you've been saying about this as well. And obviously in the fantastic sort of Joseph Moncillo series, and he talks a lot about momentum of that. And this is like the kind of perfect moment, isn't it, to illustrate Misawa's understanding of how to use the opponent's momentum against them.
Oh, definitely. If you want, you know, like we're getting to the close of this match, JP. Maybe I'm going to let you take it out, but like, you know, definitely, you know, Joseph Montecelio, the episode zero guest, does a wonderful series about this match that people should go, you know, watch after they listen to this podcast. But why don't we get to the finish? JP, do you have notes for the finish of this match?
I did. So, like, one of the things that I really like is, so they kind of, Jumbo tries to go for the suplex, and then Misawa goes behind, kind of reversal. And it's almost like Jumbo tries something that really shouldn't be in his wheelhouse when he tries to sort of turn it into reversal, into the pin attempt. But it also plays into the whole momentum, because he rolls over, gets the two. But also at the same time, it's like Misawa pushes, uses the weight of Jumbo against him to roll over and kind of get the three. And it's a kind of, it's a quick sequence, but it also plays into the overall theme, as we've kind of said so many times during this, of that kind of speed and dynamism experience that he has. And it takes Jumbo by surprise. And my Christ, the pop after that, just people completely losing it. And it's, you know, it's a flash pin, but it feels like such a big moment there. And you can see them behind that people are absolutely losing it. Yeah, it's a great moment.
So Dave Meltzer from the Wrestling Observer was at this show, and he's noted, you know, several times, like talking about this match, like afterwards people were crying in the audience, and like there was like this feeling of elation. You know, the closest thing I've experienced to that was maybe, you know, this past January when Naito beat Okada for the IWGP heavyweight title at the second night of Wrestle Kingdom this year. And people were just like, random people just high-fiving each other, because like they finally saw the culmination of something they've wanted to see for a long time. And I get the feeling this is maybe similar, to put it into context, for like what it must have been like back in, you know, June 8th in 1990 at the Budokan, like Misawa pinned Jumbo Tsuruta. And so you saw something that people had wanted to see, which was kind of like the ascent of something fresh. Like people who are longtime All Japan fans, they want to see Jumbo Tsuruta be, you know, a star in their company. But they realize, like, I think all wrestling fans realize at some point something just becomes too stale. Like you need to freshen things up in the product. And they saw this win from Misawa as being that start. We're going to enter a new phase, and it's being led by this guy who's such an incredible wrestler in his own right.
Oh, absolutely. Completely agree with that, because this is, it's like you're it's not in a sense like a tease. You have this big moment, it's great, you realize you're not at the kind of top of the story, but you know where this is going, and it's that one direction, and you know who is going to be the ace that's going to supplant him. And it doesn't write off Jumbo, it adds to Jumbo, and particularly in the rematch, which is great, where Jumbo's really desperate, but he's also very noticeable not wanting to kind of make the same mistakes that he did last time, which is obviously the kind of whole All Japan style, isn't it? And building upon these moves and building upon these moments. But it would have given a lot of hope, I imagine, to fans that things were going to be kind of changing. And it was a new domestic face, which would have been so important, and he would have been fresh. And I think, you know, Jumbo understood that, and he understood what his role was. And like, if you think of it, if you take the kind of elements of this match, it's very, very easy that you could end up, like, if you just look at the booking of this, you can end up with Billy Kidman versus Hulk Hogan, couldn't you? Where you're not putting someone over. You're just dominating them, and they have the kind of flute pin. And there's no way, like, and Jumbo, which it, I know it sounds really silly when you think of the kind of story of 1990, you think, how would a Hogan have taken that? How would a big star in WWF would have taken it at that time? There's no chance they would have done that and had the finish changed around. Whereas here, Jumbo does it. He does it the right way. He doesn't lose anything, obviously. You've got the absolute mad hype then for the rematch. And Misawa is built up as a star, and he's on that level. And then it would have been a case where you're looking at the other people there who are in the ring as well and how they're going to play a part in this. It would have been a tremendously exciting time. Because like you say, it would have been the staleness of, you know, having these kind of, you know, a Gordy versus Hansen match for a Triple Crown. I think ultimately the fans, like a lot of fans do, they like the idea of the kind of hometown heroes, don't they? And it plays into that kind of universal sports fandom. And very much Bubba at that point, he's setting up saying, right, we've got a new generation coming through. And by the way, they're class.
Oh, and like, I think, you know, the post-match is just as important because this is like something that you see like replayed again and again is that immediately after, you know, Misawa pins Jumbo, Kawada and Kobashi immediately get into the ring to celebrate with Misawa and lift him onto their shoulders. And this is like, you know, this is an image that is ingrained in wrestling history as like the start basically of these guys. This is their era is starting, like the four pillars. And this includes Taue, which I think is really interesting. Like I'm watching this post-match and, you know, Kobashi and Kawada hold Misawa on their shoulders. And we see Akira Taue as part of the scene of congratulating Misawa, but he seems like an outsider. Like he's just kind of patting Misawa on the back. And while this trio is physically connected to each other, you know, with this, like them hoisting Misawa onto their shoulders. And I'm not sure if this is deliberate or not. I don't know if this is foreshadowing, but it seems like, you know, like Taue is kind of like indicating that he's eventually going to defect away from the Super Generation Army. Because he knows he's fucked. Because, like, okay, Misawa's number one, Kawada's two, Kobashi is three, and then I'm four, and then Kikuchi's five, but I don't want to be four. I at least want to be number two. I'm not going to be number two with fucking Kawada there, because Kawada's, you know, the guy everyone knows is, you know, the guy after Misawa, and then Kobashi's going to be right after, you know, Kawada, if not surpass him later on in the years. But Taue knows, like, I'm fucked. I can't be in this group anymore. Wait, look over there. There's Jumbo. Who's he got on his team? Bunch of old dudes. Maybe he needs some fresh blood. So, like, later on, Akira Taue brilliantly, either on his own part or probably on Jumbo, Giant Baba's part, joins Tsuruta Gun to become, you know, Jumbo Tsuruta's tag team partner. And I talked about a match of theirs in the last episode, JP, but they form an awesome tag team. You know, Taue and Jumbo is just magic, and it does wonders for, I think, Taue's career.
Oh yeah, and because in some he'll never receive the credit that the others do, but the role that he plays, in particularly as well the feud he has with Kawada, and what that generally does for that kind of semi-main, but for raising them up, then the series of tags, then you get the Holy Demon Army, all of these kind of factors, and it works. And it was funny when, and again, I'm kind of looking out for these things now with the benefit of hindsight, looking back in time at it. When you're watching that and you just see Taue come up and it's just a pat on the back and then he's kind of gone. And like you say, you can see Kawada, you can see Kobashi, who's just got like an enormous smile on his face as well throughout it. And it's, and I suppose as well, they themselves inside as wrestlers would have known, right, we are going to be moving on to another stage of this. And it's not, even though Misawa might well be the ace, we're going to be obviously part of these all of these storylines as well for the upcoming future. And I think in order to make Taue stand out, it was the best move to get in with Jumbo. And like you said, it makes sense that why be the number four in one group when you're going to be the number two in the other, and that the number one isn't going to be around forever.
Oh yeah, and then like, I mean, he eternally becomes the number two because, like you said, you mentioned the Holy Demon Army, which is the tag team of Kawada and Taue. Obviously, Kawada is the number one in that group, but you know, the thing is Taue gets his taste of the Triple Crown eventually. Like he's not like It's not like he gets left out. Like, you know, Misawa holds it, Kawada holds it, Kobashi holds it, you know, and Taue holds the belt as well. So or the three belts in this case. It does wonders. I don't think he would have gotten that taste necessarily if he was, you know, if Baba kept him in the Super Generation Army, if he was the number four guy. Like, look at, you know, like Kikuchi. Kikuchi was never going to get there necessarily because he's a junior heavyweight. So he's not going to get a taste of the Triple Crown. But, like, I think also, like, Taue moving over, and we'll talk about this, I'm sure someone's going to pick at one of the amazing multi-man tag matches that the Super Generation versus Tsurugan produces, that we're going to talk about Kikuchi. And, I talked about a lot about Kikuchi in the last episode with Daniel Makabe, but, you know, like, there's a lot of, you know, like, benefits of, like, how, you know, Giant Baba kind of moves these chess pieces onto, you know, like, into making these teams and, like, creating these programs within the overall program. Like you say, Kawada versus Taue and Misawa versus Jumbo. And then Masafushi just being an asshole to everyone else.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the things that you love about wrestling the most, isn't it? Where you've got this very interesting cast of characters and you can maneuver them about and they've all got the kind of stories, and it's the sheer depth of Kawada versus Misawa going back to their high school days and the rest of it. There's so many kind of extra layers and levels, which is why this stuff, you know, we're talking that this match happens, you know, we're just over 30 years ago. And it, you know, God, this holds up. Like, this is something that you kind of think, you know, this is essential viewing. And it's also reminds you of the stuff that, certainly, I love most about wrestling, and it's the idea of these characters being true to themselves. So even when they do bad things, you know why they're doing it. It makes sense for them to do it. You may not agree with them doing it necessarily. So you speak about Taue. It makes sense for him to do that. It makes sense for Kawada later on to kind of have his feud with Misawa. You know, all of these things are logical. And in a world, in certainly a year, that's completely devoid of really any logic to it, half an hour of sort of pure logical bliss watching this is just like a reminder of a much better time.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I don't want to be one of these people that says, oh, wrestling when I was younger was so much better. But, you know, like, you know, I like a lot of modern wrestling. I really do. Mm-hmm. But there is definitely a pivot, even in, like, the companies that, you know, say they are a serious wrestling product, there is a pivot towards becoming more entertainment based. You know, it has been this way for the last 10 years in all of wrestling, and particularly in Japan, I think more than even America, because America has always been like that. But yeah, like, it's just great to go back and watch these matches. And like you say, JP, they hold up. My final thoughts on this match is, like, it's an awesome match. I don't go as high as, like, some other people. I gave it a 4.5 rating, in my own personal rating system, which, you know, the top one is, top number is 5. But I do think, like, there's better matches that they have. But this is the historical match. This is the kickoff of Misawa's ascent to eventually becoming, the ace himself, supplanting Jumbo as the top guy in this company and just ushering in this, the greatest era of in-ring professional wrestling, in my opinion, in the history of this whole wacky sport that we love so much.
Oh, God, yeah. And if you think of it, and it's, in some ways, it's like a Star Wars analogy, which is the idea that if the guy with the gun at the very start of Star Wars, if he'd shot the escape pod that C-3PO and R2-D2 escaped from, they wouldn't have met Luke. Luke wouldn't have met Obi-Wan, and so on and so forth. Here, if you think of the ramifications of you don't have this match and you don't have this moment, perhaps, you know, the version of history, do you get the four pillars? Do you get the kind of influence of the style? You know, Jumbo would have had so much faith in going, oh, yeah, the direction these guys are going in from a wrestling perspective is where we need to go as well. And as you say, it is that kind of greatest period of main event wrestling that you're going to see on that big stage. But without this match, you don't get four pillars, which then all the other people who have been so influenced from it, and I suppose the most obvious one would be someone like an Eddie Kingston. Do you even get an Eddie Kingston as a result of that? As a, you know, it's the influence of this, and it's so important for where wrestling goes worldwide. I mean, even outside of all Japan, you know, the influence of it to this day, it's, you know, you get old people like us banging on about how great this match from 30 years ago is. And it's, and, you know, we say it for a reason. It's not done out of nostalgia. It's like I say, 4.5. I think the rematch is better because it's so dramatic and it plays off so much stuff in this as well. And I'd watch both of them as a kind of companion piece to this. But yeah, this is, I don't know whether you say it, this is like, it's one of the high points of wrestling.
It is definitely. And you know, to your point, you say, do we get someone like Eddie Kingston if we don't have the Four Pillars era in the 1990s? But I would say, do we get, you know, the last 10 years of New Japan Pro Wrestling events if we don't have this? Because, like, I will tell you straight up, like, if you think that, you know, the foundation of the main event scene of New Japan Pro Wrestling with Tanahashi, Okada, Naito, Ibushi, Kenny Omega, you know, AJ Styles, even, like, if you think that comes from Strong Style, like the Three Musketeers era, it doesn't. It actually comes from this. Like, this crosses over, like, King's Road crosses over to where, you know, Strong Style is now copying King's Road, in my opinion. I mean, that might be a controversial take, and maybe some New Japan stans are going to get upset with me. I don't care. It doesn't matter to me. But, like, that's what I think, because, like, there is a clear demarcation from the time of, like, you know, Tanahashi's era of him being on top to this shift into more of a kind of King's Road element. There's still elements of what you would consider Strong Style. I mean, these are very ephemeral terms, obviously. Like, you can't really, you know, like, concretely say this is Strong Style, this is King's Road, but you know what I'm talking about, JP, right?
Like, oh, absolutely. I completely agree. I just think the gaijins they got in, they replaced the big brawlers with technicians. That's exactly what they did to fit the kind of athletic style of what we would have these days. It's a very, like, when you say it seems kind of obvious, really, that they would take from it, because it's the most logical. And if you've got those 4 or 5 people on top, you need to tell that kind of story, because you always need to keep an interest in all of them. So everything is taken from everything else, isn't it, and adapted. It's the same in any kind of popular culture, you know, music, books, films, etc. It would be silly not to be influenced by one of the greatest periods of booking that has ever existed in wrestling.
Like, well, I mean,
it's
like,
bad not to take an influence from it.
Well, I mean, it's been said that, you know, Tanahashi's favorite wrestler when he was growing up was Kenta Kobashi.
Mm.
So he was obviously a huge All Japan fan of the 1990s. So that's the kind of thing that he brings into going into, you know, like, when he joins the New Japan Dojo. It's like, obviously he's influenced by, you know, his senpais before him, Nagata and Kojima and Tenzan, people like that. And of course with, you know, Muto and Chono and people like that. But, you know, like, you can always tell, like, when he becomes the main eventer, it's very clear to see that, hey, I'm gonna, like, take all the stuff I loved as a kid and try to bring it into this, you know, this scene, this, to this company that I'm in, that I'm the leader of now.
Oh yeah. And think of the way he built up Okada as ace and the job that he did, and realizing it wasn't as simple as you put him over, it's one and done, and this is now the guy. He knew what all of the things that Okada needed in order to reach that next level. And I think in this match, you notice that with Jumbo. He knew all of the things that Misawa needed to show in order to prove to an audience that this guy is going to be the ace in the future, in the very near future.
Well, you say that, JP, and, like, a lot of people might say, oh, like, so, you know, like, Tanahashi is, like, the modern version of Misawa, or he's the modern version of Kobashi. No, mm-hmm. Like, if you think about it, like, he's the modern version of Jumbo Tsuruta.
Yeah. In some ways, he is. He's more, like, in some ways, isn't it? Because you're thinking of it, he's holding the company at a point where creatively it's pretty destabilized. I mean, it was a lot more destabilized when Tanah was on top, when he was first on top in New Japan. It was fucking shambles at that point in time. But he's the steadying influence who gets them through this period, who kind of realizes what his job is in the future, but also knows the way to do it so it'll have the most effect. Like, it's never the case of just putting someone over, isn't it? It's giving... What you're doing is you're giving the fans a reason to invest in this other person other than, and not just you. And it's a very sort of, you know, he's a selfless wrestler. And, you know, we said at the very start of this, Jumbo had lost the triple crown 3 days earlier. How often would Jumbo have lost two matches in a row? Two big high profile singles matches in a row? Like, would that have ever happened other than the sort of start of his career? And this is someone who has sort of, you know, he understood about how to do it and how to do it the right way and thought kind of the bigger picture in doing it. And obviously the fact we're talking about this match proves how successful Jumbo was as that as well. And, you know, and Tanner has that kind of similar mentality.
Yes, definitely. So let's wrap it up on that point. JP, thank you so much for joining me walking down the long and winding Royal Road. And I hope your neck's okay. And didn't take too many drops on the head there. Where can people find more of JP Houlihan?
Thank you so much. An absolute pleasure being on here. Loved it. Again, you can find more of me. I'm on Grapple Spotlight, but also Grapple Roundtable, which you can subscribe to at grapple.podbean.com or all other podcast providers. Put in Grapple, G-R-A-P-P-L. You can find me at Twitter at JPJippy as well, 3 E's.
And you can find me on Twitter at WHPark9. You can also find me every month with John Pollock on Post Perez. I don't know. I definitely want to have you back on to talk about another match from this era down the line, JP. And, you know, if no one takes the September 1st, 1990 Jumbo versus Masao match, maybe we'll do that. But, you know, someone else wants to do that, that's perfectly fine. We can always talk about maybe, global energetic tough. I'm sure a favorite faction of yours, talking about the Del Wilkes, Johnny Ace, you know, taking Kenny Kobashi to new levels with their alliance with him, but or something actually good, like, you know, the Holy Demon Army versus, you know, Misawa and Kobashi or Misawa and Akiyama or something like that. But thank you again. And on behalf of all the listeners, I want to say thank you. I really appreciate a lot of the positive feedback people have been giving the show. And until next time, I will say goodbye.
The changing of seasons can affect how you feel. 1 in 5 people experience some form of depression, no matter the time of year.
At the American Psychiatric Association Foundation, our vision is to build a mentally healthy nation for all. Visit mentallyhealthynation.org to learn more.